Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Andrew Cuomo says he'll take legal action against the federal government after the Justice Department admitted in court papers late last week that it was untruthful in its rationale for banning New Yorkers' access to the Trusted Traveler program. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
The dispute between New York and the Trump administration began in 2019 when the state allowed undocumented immigrants to apply for standard driver's licenses. It also barred the federal government from obtaining information about the immigrants through those licenses. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security claimed that because New York's DMV was blocking their access to some of the agency's data, they could no longer safely issue fast-tracked air travel programs. That includes the TSA PreCheck and the Trusted Traveler Global Entry programs. The announcement of that ban came one day after President Donald Trump's State of the Union speech. It criticized New York's immigration policies. Cuomo, at the time, argued that several other states already offered driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants and that New York was being singled out for political reasons.
If 15 other states have the same green light program, why just New York? There are Republican states that have the green light program.
In papers filed Thursday in a lawsuit brought by the state, the acting U.S. attorney for Southern New York admitted that its argument was inaccurate and that New York's policies were not different from other states who allow the immigrants access to driver's licenses. New Yorkers were immediately reinstated to the Trusted Traveler programs. One day later, Cuomo is still angry.
They got caught. It was all politics all the time. It was all exploitation all the time. And they hurt this state because of it.
Cuomo says the actions were illegal and the federal officials violated their oaths of office. He says the state intends to file criminal charges and seek civil damages in court. The governor also says when the program was suspended in the winter, it backed up lines in airports. He says the policy might have contributed to the COVID crisis that hit New York in March and April and killed thousands, because in February, people were flying to New York City's airports from Europe and were already infected with the virus.
It is at the exact same time that we know COVID is coming in on European flights. And now you packed people into waiting rooms and on lines who didn't need to be on the line because you were playing politics. How do you quantify that?
Cuomo admits he does not have any hard data to back up that claim. The governor's also asking House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and House Judiciary Chair and New York Congressman Jerry Nadler to launch an investigation. New York senior U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer is also calling for a probe by the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and New York Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul were at the Unity House in Troy this week to meet with local child care providers and call for critical support for the industry. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there.
America's child care system has come off the rails as the pandemic-battered economy struggles to right itself. With New York in Phase 4 of reopening, many parents have to return to work, but not all children will be returning to school. Gillibrand says child care was already a challenge before the coronavirus hit. She stressed the urgency of getting child care providers financial relief.
They need support and they need clear guidelines. Right now, they don't have either. On Friday, I sent a letter to the CDC that outlines the needs and the recommendations of child care providers in New York. They request that the CDC first provide clarification about the disparities between the CDC guidelines and the state guidelines. Second, offer additional information about how the use of safety protocols like face shields and social distancing will impact the interaction with children. And consider the unity of care when recommending alternating days, half days, or other reduced schedules.
Aside from trying to bounce back from months of lost revenue, Gillibrand points out that child care providers must bear the costs of stocking PPE supplies while reconfiguring their facilities to comply with social distancing regulations.
That's why I will keep pushing to make sure the next COVID package includes the Child Care is Essential Act. This would provide $50 billion of grant funding to help providers cover these new costs and costs for making rent, mortgage, and utility payments so they can keep their doors open. And it will ensure that these providers can pay their employees and help pay their employees and help to offset some of the additional costs for child care for families.
Hochul, also a Democrat, sees Gillibrand's plan as key to getting the economy back on track.
$50 billion of support for states to be able to assist child care centers and direct assistance to child care centers is absolutely essential, or the economy will not come back on all cylinders like we desperately need it to do. So we are sending a message to Washington.
Gillibrand adds she has four different bills aimed at making daycare more affordable.
We have one that doubles the tax deduction for middle-class families. We have one that allows for a tax credit for low-income families. And I support universal pre-K to make a whole year similar to public school so that it's covered for all 3- and 4-year-olds. I also have legislation for early childhood education to increase the amount of money that we give to Head Start and other early childhood education programs specifically for at-need and at-risk children.
According to Gillibrand, it would take at least $9.6 billion per month to keep current child care providers in business and ensure providers that closed due to the pandemic can safely reopen.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, very interesting analysis this week came out where more than a dozen colleges and universities in New York State are expected among those likely to, quote, perish amid the coronavirus pandemic. This is a New York University marketing professor. It's got many of these colleges upset. It's got people talking. And the interesting thing is that many of these colleges certainly would be seen as successful, like Skidmore and Bard, Fordham, Pace, other colleges like that, even the Sage colleges in the Albany area. But we're seeing with this pandemic and the lack of students on campus, for example, no room and board, and the financial hit they're taking certainly are putting some of them in trouble.
David, what this professor did is he took a look at the money, and many of these places have been on a course of working with very little in the way of ongoing resources. Along comes the pandemic, and it gets even worse. And not only does it get worse for the colleges themselves, but everybody around the colleges. You know, I worked for years at DuPaul's. There will be businesses that suffer as a result of this. If the governor says everybody wears a mask and everybody stay out of social engagements, you can just see what is going to happen. In any case, I think that, you know, the professor probably has a point about his study, but I think it's way too early to say these places will close up. I have a feeling that these colleges and universities are hardly done yet because they all have people who went there. They have people who understand how important a Bard or any of these other places can be and will. When you hear names like Bard or Skidmore, it really does put pimples on the side of your arm, that is for sure. And my feeling is by no means are they done yet.
And it's coming fast, Alan. The students, according to many of the plans I'm seeing from the area colleges, including the University at Albany, call for them to be on campus earlier and end earlier for the semester. The semester at UAlbany starts August 24th, but students are expected to start arriving 2 weeks before. So with faculty now coming out saying they're concerned about being on campus and staff and even the students you're seeing, in some cases, taking the semester off. You know, anything could change at this point. Even the regular schools, K through 12, are facing a decision next week by Governor Cuomo. And we know the parents and teachers' unions and others are worried about all this.
And they should be. Hey, look, this is a pandemic. We see it reaching into the White House. We see people all over the state getting the disease. And New York is in great shape compared to some of these other places. So, you know, one has to worry about if you move forward, do you make this thing worse? And the answer is maybe you do. Maybe you do. I mean, is there anybody who thinks that there won't be any cases at all? And as we have seen, it takes one person testing positive, one person to transmit this disease to a lot of other people. You got one person walks into a party, and we've seen 25, 30 people getting infected. And then they go out, and they do their own infecting. Yeah, this is an almost unsolvable problem. Now,
and it all comes down to money in the end, with the schools, with the unemployment benefits for people, with the need for food to be on the table, the food insecurity that's going on. The governor now has written a letter to New York's congressional delegation urging them not to settle for a federal stimulus package that does not include aid to states hard hit by the coronavirus. Of course, we're down on the wire. It looks like the president of the United States is going to let this deal fail for the time being, and people are going to get hurt. So the governor has been very clear. If we don't get the money, these schools, for example, healthcare could face a 20% cut, and they've already factored that we're $30 billion in the hole for the next 2 years.
No question. We do know about the $16 billion this year, and I've been saying right along that I think that's an underestimate. The governor has said the feds have to help the state. The president of the United States sits there and says, well, you know, my kid's going to go to school. I think this is just a terrible, terrible situation in which the president thinks he's being a tough negotiator and that the states don't have to get this money. Well, they do. It's in the obviously in the House of Representatives bill. The Senate goes along, as they always have, the Republican majority, and they support the president. And it does look like there may be hell to pay in New York State.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The New York State Legislature recently passed a number of environmental bills that await Governor Andrew Cuomo's signature. Among them is a fracking-related bill that would be a first in the nation. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn with more.
Rob Hayes is Clean Water Associate at Environmental Advocates of New York.
This is a precedent-setting bill. New York would be the first state in the nation to finally declare that fracking waste is hazardous. And the state legislature took an enormous step to make sure that this dangerous substance is not shipped into our state and does not continue to pollute clean waters across the southern tier and across the state.
It was December 2014 when Governor Cuomo announced New York would ban fracking, the first such announcement in the country. This April, the state legislature codified the fracking ban as part of the budget. Environmental Policy Director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, Liz Moran.
Despite that ban, we've still been accepting fracking waste from Pennsylvania's operations and our landfills since at least 2011, if not earlier. There's a loophole that exists federally that a number of states replicated that exempt oil and gas waste from being handled and treated as hazardous waste.
Hayes says another bill would protect a certain class of streams in New York.
There are about 40,000 miles of Class C streams in New York that will have new protections if Governor Cuomo signs this bill. These streams are absolutely critical to filtering out pollutants and keeping our drinking water free from contamination.
One is Silver Stream, which feeds into Washington Lake in Newburgh. The lake was the drinking water source for the city of 30,000 until PFOS contamination was reported in 2015. PFOS-contaminated water still flows from Stewart Air National Guard Base, but the city now draws its drinking water from the Catskill Aqueduct. NYPERG's Moran.
Because a lower-class stream didn't have the same protections as others, it further enabled contamination to get into Newburgh's drinking water source from Department of Defense Air Base.
Hayes thinks state lawmakers would consider adding other classes down the road.
With the rollbacks that we've been seeing from the Trump administration, how they have been eviscerating protections for clean water, New York needs to take as much action as possible to make sure that we're standing up for people's drinking water.
And there's a bill that would ban the manufacture, selling, and distribution of food packaging that contains PFAS substances. NYPERG's Moran.
PFAS chemicals are used for their water-resistant properties and consequently grease-resistant properties. They've been used in food containers over the years, microwave popcorn bags, for example, which means that's a way that we're directly ingesting these chemicals and entering them in our bodies. So the legislature passed a really important piece of legislation that takes a class-based approach and would ban the use of these chemicals in food containers in New York State.
If the bill is signed, New York would be among the few states with such a law.
Washington State is the first in the country that passed a law like this. But it's important to keep the trend up, and it's important to keep building on the work we're doing to address PFAS chemicals in the environment.
Other environmental bills on the governor's desk include one to ban the use of glyphosate on state property. Glyphosate is a commonly used herbicide, more commonly known by trade names like Roundup. And there's legislation that would ban certain types of trichloroethylene, or TCE, a toxic chemical and known human carcinogen.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
The New York Farm Bureau sent a survey to all its members last month to assess the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on agriculture across the state. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has the results.
The survey found that 65% of farmers and agribusiness owners had been negatively or very negatively impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. 43% have lost sales, and more than a third have cash flow issues caused by the pandemic. Most farms, 84%, have a plan in place to train and assist employees to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. There was an opportunity to briefly describe any changes to deal with the pandemic, and answers ranged from transitioning to internet sales, cutting production, to selling livestock. Farm Bureau President David Fisher, who owns a dairy farm in Madrid, New York, says no farm has been untouched by the pandemic.
Unpredictability comes with farming. Look no further than the weather. This year, we're dealing with an exceptionally hot summer and drought conditions for much of the state. As the state and federal governments have looked toward potential budget cuts and COVID assistance, agriculture must be a part of the discussion. In the end, COVID continues to affect our farms in big ways and small, and we hope this survey helps government officials and consumers better understand what we're all going through.
Tony Lapierre co-owns Rusty Creek Farm in Chazee, north of Plattsburgh. He says the dairy farm was planning to expand production, but that's been put on hold due to lost markets caused by the pandemic.
The vendors that we've had made commitments to, plumbing, electricians, building materials, equipment dealers for the melting equipment, all that money that would be injected into the local economies is no longer going to be there. And we started last year making financial commitments. So moving forward, what's concerning if we don't have these markets or prices, how are we going to navigate through these commitments to either hopefully expand in the next year or two, or if not, what are we going to do to change gears so that we can meet our financial obligations?
Dressel Farms grows fruits, especially apples, in New Paltz. Co-owner Sarah Dressel Nichols says although their wholesale market has dropped off, foot traffic in their farm store has picked up.
Our sales at our market have increased dramatically due to a combination of people from New York City who came up north. Other farm markets around have told the same thing, that they've been extremely busy. At our retail stand, we've had to change the layout so that people weren't handling the produce that they weren't buying, and so that our employees who were wearing masks and gloves could handle the produce and give it to people safely and to, ensure social distancing. So So we've been really grateful for that because it's not easy to do anything else in the wholesale market. It's been really tough. So having a direct market do well is really positive.
The New York Farm Bureau received over 500 responses to the statewide 2020 COVID-19 Farm and Agribusiness Survey. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now is Bob Schneider. He is the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, David, and thanks for having me today.
Oh, so great to have you on the program. Obviously, the big question is to go back to school or not. If so, how? And you've surveyed your members. Why don't you give us a little look-see into what you found out?
Well, we did a short survey. We call it the Pulse Poll, and we asked three questions. The first one was, do you think the guidance issued by the state is comprehensive and granular enough for your district to create school reopening plans by July 31st? And 42% said yes, 35% said no, and 24% said not sure. So we kind of had a split group there as far as are they, you know, that the guidance was helpful. And I know SED just yesterday released an extension for the reopening plans for a 7-day extension. Will be due next week for them to submit their survey, if you will, that SED requires for the reopening plan. So they're giving schools a little more time, and maybe that will shift some of that no vote, if you will, as far as the plans not being comprehensive and granular enough. Maybe it'll give them more time to absorb it. The second question was, putting aside cost considerations, do you support, not support having students return to in-classroom instruction in September? And we school board members support on a part-time basis, meaning a hybrid model where the students would be in the classroom for some time and then distance learning for some of the other time. We had 35% of our respondents agree to that. Support on a full-time basis, 43% said that they would prefer a full-time basis if costs were not a consideration. So that's a large number. 72% of our members that we polled think that, you know, students need to be back in the classroom. It's vital to have that in-classroom instruction, not only for the education component, but then again, you've got the social and emotional supports, the relationships they have with their peer students, the relationships they have with their teachers, administrators, other people, their guidance counselors. So we know it's very important. And if there weren't these major cost considerations to reopen schools this year, yes, we want our students back in the schools. And also, don't forget, we want to make sure that the health and safety measures are there so there won't be issues with a spread in regards to COVID-19. And then the final question we had, in the absence of more state or federal funding, do you feel you can safely open school in accordance with State Education Department and State Department of Health guidance documents? Dovetailing on what I just said, without the funding, 29% said feel they could safely reopen, 44% said no, and 26 were not sure. So the majority are on the side of obviously saying we need more money. We need federal funding money. And we also need to make sure the governor doesn't impose state aid cuts on school funding. It's going to cost us a lot of money, once again, to do the proper reopening. In any year, it costs money to reopen schools. This year, it's going to be a really heavy lift. There's so many things you have to consider when you're reopening schools. And in this situation, you've got to consider additional transportation costs because you have to socially distance the students on the bus. There's going to be PPE requirements, supplies we need. We're going to have health checks, costs, and things like that. There's so many costs, HVAC, reviews, if you will, making sure the airflow is optimal. The list goes on and on. So you can imagine, in order to keep our students, our staff, and our administrators and other building staff safe and healthy, we've got to do all this by September, and it's going to cost a lot of money. So we are hopeful that the federal government will give us that stimulus, not only obviously our state, but the entire country to support this.
And I imagine if they don't come through with it, and as the governor has now said, we're talking about a
10% cut
mm-hmm.
in education. Yeah. I imagine your members surveyed after that fact would find it very hard to go back to school without anything in place and with very little money to go with.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, I don't want to predict this, but if that occurs, we might be seeing a full distance learning model, if you will, where we can't open up the buildings, and that's going to be terrible on our students. This whole problem is going to end up being rested on the backs of our students, and it's not fair for them. The distance learning model works to a certain degree, but it will never, ever replace in-building classroom and other activities that a student experiences. And all the other programs, the enrichment programs, the arts, the sports, they've got to have that in a physical setting to really make it a true education for them.
And as you point out, you know, there are differences in school districts and the resources that are available to begin with. And now you add in online instruction, and we've seen from even in certain cities where there are very poor population,
yes.
as well as rural communities in the North Country,
correct.
For example,
correct.
They don't have the ability to either get online because the technology isn't there, or they don't have the money for it.
This is true. And schools are trying to be creative to address that problem. They're identifying the students that don't have the tablets or the laptops or the broadband. We've seen some plans where they've converted gyms and cafeterias into Wi-Fi hotspots so those students can get in there into these large rooms and have the access and have the equity, if you will, in education. The digital divide, which was there prior to the pandemic, which is basically you defined it, that's been expanded. It's gotten a lot larger. We found about 27% of our students statewide either don't have the broadband access or they don't have the equipment. Imagine being a student and trying to learn your curriculum on a cell phone. It just can't happen. So we have to address that. And we are also looking for funding from the federal government to address this digital divide. And it's not only equipment, it's the broadband internet, and that's infrastructure cost that needs to occur, especially in these rural and some of these urban areas, in order to create an equitable education for all students. The students that are at risk the most right now, it's getting worse for them, and we need to recognize that and address it.
Robert Schneider is the executive director of the New York State School Boards Association. Bob, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week.
Well, thank you, David, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. As for program number 2031, or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.